Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. Today we focus on local farming as the final days of August roll out. Farm stands are bursting with offerings of fresh, beautiful produce, and cooking can be quick, simple, and delicious. But how often in our hectic lives, do we pause to wonder about what went into the growing of the deeply purple eggplant or a succulent tomato picked up for dinner? Also, what happens to the produce that doesn't get sold or even pulled from the field? Some groups are making certain that it goes to people who happen to be food insecure. And finally, who are the next generation of farmers? Classes will soon get underway once again at a unique agricultural high school in Philadelphia. This hour, we get three different perspectives on local farming as we welcome Jess Niederer, owner of Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey. Hello, Jess.
Hi, Mary.
Kathy Snyder is the founder and executive director of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue, an organization in Bucks County, which connects hunger relief sites with local farmers to help distribute extra produce to those who are food insecure. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, this is great to be here, Mary. Thanks.
And Gail Koskela is an animal sciences teacher at the Walter B. Saul Agricultural Sciences High School, part of the Philadelphia Public School District. Welcome, Gail, or Miss K.
Yes.
As your students call you.
Yes, thank you.
And as always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Jess, first to you, tell us a little bit about Chickadee Creek Farm. How big is it? And give us a sense of what it is exactly that you grow.
Okay. Chickadee Creek Farm grows vegetables on 14 acres, but we lease 20 acres on an entire 80-acre farm. And I think sometimes an acre is a weird thing to visualize, but an acre is about the size of a football field. So if you want to try to think of managing 14 football fields of vegetables, that's what myself and a crew of eight other farmers on our place do. And we grow organically. We sell all of our vegetables at farmers markets throughout New Jersey. We go to seven of them a week, so that keeps us crushingly busy during most of the growing season.
And in my discussion with Alex Stern, our producer, ahead of this show, I know that you're familiar also with the fact that sometimes not all produce gets sold or there's extra produce. And this is where we bring Kathy into the conversation. Kathy, this is where Rolling Harvest comes in, when there's extra and you help to make sure it gets to go where it really needs to go.
That's right. We've created the logistics that can help get all of this surplus and sometimes beautifully imperfect produce. Imagine the cucumber with a curve, for example, or the carrot that has too many legs. Lots of reasons for farmers to have surplus, and we have great working relationships with all of them. And we know where to send the food that we are picking up or the food that we're in the fields gleaning.
Gleaning. Define gleaning.
It's a term from the Bible, and we are a modern-day gleaning organization, where the farmers, in the Bible at least, were mandated to leave the corners of their fields for the poor and the immigrants to come. Well, we don't have a society where our people who are most at need are right next to our agricultural growers, so we take over from there. We go to the fields when farmers call us for a variety of reasons. Just last week, we got almost 3,000 pounds of organic tomatoes from Chickadee Creek Farm, and it was a last-minute request, and we put a call out to gleaners, and we harvested and donated immediately to so many hunger relief sites.
We'll get into that some more in just a few moments. But Gail, guessing that many of our listeners, including myself, did not realize that the Philadelphia School District offers an agricultural school. How is Saul distinguished from other high schools in the district?
Saul is not only distinguished from other high schools in Philadelphia, but it is unique in the country. And Saul High School has been at the location that it's at since the 50s. It's had many different, not versions, but many different focus that Saul High School has done. At the beginning, I have an anecdotal feeling that it may have been the place to send some of the young men who couldn't behave very well in class so that they could go learn some work skills and get out of some people's hair. But it's really grown over the decades. Saul High School has become a special admit high school for the School District of Philadelphia. Students can come from anywhere in the district and apply to come to SAUL, similar to the other special admit schools like Central and Girls High.
And you get a lot of kids who want to get in there.
We do. We get a pretty good application rate. We have currently a student body of about 520, 9th through 12th grade, and we probably filtered through 1,000 applications for this freshman class. We also then have the recruitment of making sure that, kids can really take full advantage of SAUL and really bloom in that setting are finding out about it, because with the competition with all of the burgeoning options with charter schools and everything else, there's a lot of information for families and students to go through.
So as an animal sciences teacher, what do you typically teach in a day?
We like to focus on the fact that we teach students. The area of expertise that I have grown into as a SAUL teacher over the last over 15 years is working primarily with the production of the sheep and beef cattle and introduction to animal science, just giving kids a good insight into what that career path can be, the variety of things they can do. So we do a lot of learning about large animal care, management, the business of animal agriculture, and really giving kids an advantage. Our students, if they choose to continue in animal science, when they go to college, they may be very anxious being a Philadelphia student going to an agricultural college. But when they get there, they realize they've had opportunities to work with animals that a lot of other pre-vet students have not. And they can really carry that with confidence into their future careers, whether they're human medicine, animal medicine, if they're going into areas of agricultural legislation. I mean, we have students that work with Congress also that come out of our program.
There's also the produce piece of it. Mm-hmm. And Jess mentioned that she farms organically. Mm-hmm. Is there now at SAUL, are there courses now, because it seems to be a burgeoning field, that talk about organic?
Yeah, SAUL's set up overall as far as for the coursework for the students. When they come in as freshmen, since agriculture is not well known by anybody because we're so separated from the fields of agriculture, the freshmen, when they come in, they get a variety of information about our four majors that we have. So it's animal science, horticulture or plant science, food products and processing, and environmental. And then from there, they choose where they want to specialize the next 3 years. And within those, we also have the partnerships with the school and with the Henry Got Crops program, which is where we do a bulk of the produce production through Henry Got Crops. So that's a resource that the teachers can use either in the introductory courses or later on in environmental or in the horticulture programs, so the students can see a actively working, producing crop farm. So we're not just doing demonstration plots. We're not just doing a petting zoo. We're actually
hands-on,
functionally solving everyday problems that come up with agricultural production. Anytime you're dealing with living things, you're going to have built-in problem solving that the students are fully integrated into.
Let's talk about agricultural production from your end, Jess. Mm-hmm. 9-to-5 job? I guess not.
No.
Tell us what your day looks like.
It's fairly on-call of a job, but you're kind of on-call all the time. So we stay pretty busy even in the winter because we do grow greens throughout the winter, and we also produce a large amount of storage crops that we will continue going to market with throughout the whole year. Last year, we only didn't have sales 1 week of the year. So we try to make local produce available year-round. In the winter, I'd say that it's about a 50-hour work week. And right now, we have crew members that are ranging in a work week time from about 55 hours to closer to 90 hours, just depending on what our individual role is on the farm.
And it's 7 days a week.
For some of us, it's 7 days a week, just depending on, for me right now, it's 7 days a week.
And how do you deal with that? Without the, I'm assuming you can't take a vacation for a little while, and it is, you know, it's obviously an enormous responsibility. You have to love it.
You would definitely have to love it. I'm listening to the conversation about training kids to farming, and I'd say that there's a part of deciding whether or not you want to farm where you're learning about your tolerances for just extreme physical activity or extreme weather variation that you're going to have to work through. So I believe it would be a combination of loving agriculture and also having some built-in tolerances for discomfort and
stamina.
And yeah, there would just have to be, I think you don't keep farming if you're not okay with ignoring stuff that's really uncomfortable and very unpleasant to you. Just sweating. Extreme sweating for like 5 days in a row while it's over 90 and you can't breathe. Or on the flip side of that, in the winter. And though, I mean, livestock farmers especially have to deal with winter cold. With the vegetable end, we've put ourselves in a position where we're also dealing with winter cold with working year round. But it doesn't matter if there's a blizzard outside. You still have to be on the farm caring for your infrastructure, making sure that our plants, in our case, are well tended to. And then, so you mentioned, you know, the bounty of the season right now. The bounty is heavy. The bounty weighs a lot. So it's another discomfort to put up for. It's just actually getting all of that yield out of the field onto a market truck set up on a market table. And then back to Kathy's organization, too, getting that excess yield or the seconds, the less than perfect stuff, it's a physical job moving this material around from place to place.
And I did want to bring you back into the conversation, Kathy, because Jess had mentioned the words on call. Are you on call with Rolling Harvest? I guess you must be.
We've been likened to an organ donation call center. Yes, and it's
what's
not
that like?
It's not nearly life or death, but these are perishable, precious fruits and vegetables that we know will mean a lot to people who wouldn't normally have access to it. And I will get text messages 6 in the morning, 9 at night, last minute. We love it. What's it like?
So when
we
you get
it.
That text morning, text message rather, at 6 in the morning, I mean, is your whole day kind of cleared because you never know what's going to happen with Rolling Harvest and you're ready to spring into action or get other people into action? Or how does that work?
That's what we do. We roll with it. I love it. When you have no idea what any given day is going to be. There are many scheduled gleanings. There's scheduled distributions, lots of different models. But one of the reasons for us to be really careful with the scope and scale of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue is that we can maintain these relationships. We can be very responsive to what the farmers need.
All right. We are talking this hour about farming, local farming. We've got three different perspectives from Kathy Snyder of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue, Gail Cascella of the Saul High School Agricultural School of Sciences in Philadelphia, and Jeff Niederer, owner of Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey. So stay with us here on Radio Times. We'll get your calls and comments in just a moment as well. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain. Local farming is our focus. In studio with us, Jess Niederer, a fourth-generation farmer and owner of Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey. Also, Gail Cascella is an animal science teacher at Walter B. Saul High School, part of the Philadelphia Public School District. And Kathy Snyder is founder and executive director of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue. And Kathy, let's get to you for a moment. Let's talk about food insecurity some more. What does the need look like? Who are we talking about here? All walks of life? Or many walks of life?
Anyone, anywhere, any zip code. And what's really been part of the process of building Rolling Harvest and having it grow very organically was when I started volunteering at a local food pantry, I really had no idea what the local face of hunger looked like and why it would even exist in a county as prosperous as Bucks County. Rich River towns, Frenchtown, New Hope, there is hunger and food insecurity basically among 15% of the population, even in prosperous counties like we're talking Montgomery County as well.
So how much food does Rolling Harvest help to facilitate to get from the fields, from the farmers to the people who need it per year, say?
Well, we really believe that we're just scratching the surface, and we are almost at the milestone of 2 million pounds being rescued, recovered, and redistributed to people who would never normally have access to it. So on a given year, we've been growing exponentially as we add more and more farms, more and more sites, hunger relief sites, emergency feeding sites are reaching out to us. And as our volunteer base is growing to well over 150 people now who are on call as much as we are, they're extraordinary. There's an opportunity to get so much more. And if we are looking at 2 million pounds in 6 years being rescued, we are still leaving stuff behind in the fields. We still have farms that may not know how easy it is and how seamless the process can be. So there's a lot of work to do.
So, Kathy, with most farmers' markets, of course, you pay for the produce you take home. How does it work with people who might not have the means?
We set up many different distribution models. The first is the food pantries in our area. So we will make direct deliveries to food pantries, shelters, soup kitchens, different hunger relief models, for example, low-income senior centers, low-income senior housing. The farmers never get charged for what they share with us. No site ever gets charged for what they receive. So it's really based on passionate, committed volunteers, and us being crazy enough to do this in all weather, as Jess was talking about. Yeah. All weather, all climates.
So speaking of, oh, go ahead.
Well, yeah. I was going to say one of the things that Saul's able to contribute to this is not only are students learning some of the technical aspects of working in different areas of agriculture, but they all are also learning a lot of the current issues and what the policy issues are. We have students that compete with some of their research at the World Food Prize, which is working on issues of food security on a global scale. We have students that get involved with many of the organizations throughout the city and just become problem solvers in the city, whether it's with youth being successful or whether it's dealing with education in the communities. And it's really interesting to see as kids come to Saul with a real vague idea, they start to really see all of the opportunities get involved. And one of our other big benefits of having Saul High School is that we're not only raising producers, but we're also raising the future consumers and the future marketers and the future of the entire industry and the entire farm-to-table industry.
I think it's also important that you're raising future policymakers because, thank goodness, this conversation now about food that's going to waste and food that is being dumped into landfills and what our food policies are in this country, this is becoming mainstream media conversation, food too good to waste.
Jess, comment that food that you work, you know, backbreaking work, as you've just described, to produce, and then some of it ends up in landfills. Maybe not necessarily yours, but, you know, farmers. How does that strike you?
So it strikes me as entirely preventable. And in our case, I think Rolling Harvest Food Rescue might have been born around the same time that Chickadee Creek was, because we've worked with them for a while and have been able to not have the weight on our shoulders of wasting food because of it. When we have things that are left over from farmers markets and are in perfect shape, or when because of either crop planning mistakes on our end or unpredictable weather events on the farm, we have too much of something, we can seriously just make a call and that gets
to Kathy's organization.
Yeah, so
he's taken care of.
I mean, it would feel pretty ridiculous to have it wasted.
We've got a question from Kelly who says, I'm a professor. Food insecurity has hit colleges and universities in a major way in the past 5 to 10 years. Is Rolling Harvest working at all with food insecure college students, Kathy?
Well, we do have a relationship with DelVal University in Bucks County. They started as an agricultural school. One of the things that they've created is their own donation garden. With this agricultural school, they've got 5 acres set aside to donate. And we've had conversations that the students at that school should have access as well.
Right. On a much lighter note, Gail, we have a Facebook comment from Peggy who says, Saul High School always has wonderful exhibits every year at the Philadelphia Flower Show. So your kids put together an exhibit for the flower show? What that must take it's, a lot of time and dedication.
Yeah, it's not – you can't even consider it a high school level. They are outdoing a lot of the professionals at Flower Show, and people go to Flower Show just to get to see what Saul and the horticulture department has come up with. Another area where our students really get to stand out is, and it's something I've been able to be part of, is taking students to the State Farm Show in Harrisburg in January. And I actually put out a call on social media for my alumni from Saul to tell me why Saul had been important to their professional and personal development. And some of the students immediately mentioned being able to have an animal that they selected, they raised, they trained, and they're exhibiting it at a major, major show in Harrisburg. And to see the confidence that they get from that, and also the networking. Because when we were talking about future policymakers, we have current policymakers. We have graduates that are working with the U.S. Congressional Department, or let me get it right, U.S. Congressional Agricultural Committee, that they're on that committee. We've had graduates that were assistants to the Pennsylvania Secretary of Agriculture. We have graduates, these are people that spoke up on social media to say, hey, I've done this, run their own flower shows, and then also, or flower shops, and then also we have heads of departments in Parks and Rec keeping nature and environment in our public spaces.
So Gail Cascella, if a parent and or a child, a young person is listening to this show, and the young person says, well, boy, this is interesting, or maybe they just have a love for horses or for animals, you know, your neck of the woods. Who is the ideal candidate for Saul? Because again, you know, there are a lot of young people trying to get in and a handful make the cut.
The ideal candidate for Saul goes back to what we were talking about, is some of your tolerance for challenging situations. And I also was thinking of the beautifully imperfect produce. All of those things illustrate Saul kids for me. There are kind of three paths that I can illustrate that kids come to Saul. Some of them have known the secret because their families have been to Saul, and they've learned about this amazing opportunity, and they come through that channel. Some kids have just been fortunate enough to have the guidance counselor resources, which are so limited in the school district, that they've gotten a chance to get a hold of a good guidance counselor that pointed them towards Saul. And then the third are those kids who know they want something to be excited about when they go to school. And they come and find out that at Saul, you want to be there every day. Because if something's giving birth, it's not going to be able to be repeated tomorrow. So you want to be at school. And we just heard at our CTE meeting yesterday that those kids that attend 90% or more, they're going to be successful. Yeah. And the kids that are coming to the Career Tech Ed program, Saul being a part of that, they want to be there.
Jess, let's talk about young farmers, people who want to break into the business. Land is expensive.
Yes.
I'd read that you are working right now to buy the farm, right, from your dad. But quite often, you know, especially I guess if farmland has been in, you know, somebody's hands for a long time, they may be reluctant to sell it, or it's very expensive. What's it like for somebody on the younger side to try to break into farming these days?
So I would say one of the things I was thinking about when Gail was talking is that when you're considering farming, the number one thing you should do is go work on a farm before thinking about buying the farm.
So go work in the fields.
Yeah. So just make sure you really like it and that you have an aptitude for it, because it is a skillful profession. I think there's some stereotypes about the level of intelligence farmers might have sometimes, but you're required to be able to be a mechanic and an accountant and an employee manager and put up with all the nasty weather stuff that has been mentioned. and withstand a fair amount of burnout. So I really think that when people are considering agriculture, it's super important to get the on-the-ground experience to see if you really do love that job.
Have you experienced burnout?
Every August, so right now in the thick of it. But this is my 10th season, 11th or 12th farming vegetables. So I understand that August too shall pass.
So where is the satisfaction for you? Why do you keep doing this?
One nice thing about our farm is that a lot of us that work on the farm also go to the farmers markets. So we are also selling the vegetables to our customers. And our customers are absolutely wonderful. They are really savvy consumers who understand what it took to grow the food, often because they are having it handed off by the farmer and we can explain what it took. So there's a lot of satisfaction in being able to deliver something that's actually healthy, actually good for the customer, and knowing that we really did do what we could to respect our local watershed, our local ecology in the production of that food, and like our local worker landscape as well. So just trying to treat people right.
I've got to add something here.
Jump in, Gabby.
The farmers are extraordinary. So all of the Rolling Harvest farm partners, and we've got about 43 different growers and food producers we work with in the region, they're incredibly humble. They're not going to promote the joy of knowing that the fruits of their labor are not going to waste by helping people who are dealing with all sorts of diet-related illnesses. They're not going to promote that they're helping to address this food inequality of what food pantry recipients get that leads to much higher incidences of diabetes and high blood pressure.
All nutritious food is generally more expensive than fast food.
That's why we're able to do this. We can change the dynamic, but the thing that I want to say about Jess and all the farmers we work with, their passion for feeding their community and feeding their neighbors, where the financial reward is never the first thing.
So, Kathy, what happens when you run into people who are not familiar with some of the produce that hits the stand? Something's a little bit more unusual. Maybe it's not culturally they're familiar with it. How do you work around that so that that food doesn't go to waste?
That is a great question, and it has led to a real ramping up of our nutrition education outreach programs. Because when we got started, we would say, yay us, we're bringing mustard greens and kohlrabi to the food pantry. Well, we would go back a few days later, guess what? It would be in the trash. Mm. That made us part of the problem, not the solution. I realized educating not just the recipients, but the food pantry volunteers, the shelter volunteers, the neighbors, the neighborhoods. What is this food? Why is it great for you? And we have our whole nutrition ed team.
Do you have recipes?
We have recipes in English and Spanish. They are designed for low income. We're not going to ask for pricey exotic ingredients. The most expensive part is we provide the vegetables. But the same thing, if you're at a farm market and the farmer gives you a sample, you're going to be 50% more likely to take that home. Same thing with free food distribution. Let them try it. Let them see that their kids will even like it. And it's made an enormous difference in how we're honoring this incredible gift from our farmers.
We've got a question from one of our listeners. How has the growing season been this summer? Jess, you're... How's all the rain impacted your
Right.
Your
so we all know there's been a lot of rain recently. And I think it can be harder to remember that there was a ton of rain all spring. And it stayed really cold for a really long time.
So what did this mean to you? What were you trying to... trying to plant in the spring.
Yeah,
how did that impact you?
It rained more than half of the days throughout May, which should be a month where we're planting almost every other day. And you can't plant when the soil's wet. You can't till the ground when the soil's wet. So we had things that were delayed 3, 4, 5 weeks. And then because we have to have other crops going in later, that pushes back the whole schedule gets transposed.
Well, how do you jump around that then?
Sometimes you can't. So, I mean, I wish I could say that farmers like can find a solution for every problem, but we're dealing with a natural system. So sometimes we're just not going to be able to plant everything we plan to, or sometimes we're not going to be able to plant it in the right spot that we had wanted to for following a rotation. And basically wet weather for all types of farmers, organic, conventional, whatever, means weeds. You're going to be fighting weeds.
And with organic farming, is your team out there just hand-pulling weeds?
There is a fair amount of hand-pulling of weeds, but there's also a bunch of really cool equipment that you can use to do. It's called tractor-based cultivation, so you're using tractors with implements attached to it to help fight the weeds. It's basically like mechanized hoeing. So we do that as much as possible. However, when it's wet, that doesn't work. So it becomes a lot harder. It was a horrendous spring, really.
So well, if we tie into how the weather's affecting things on our side, we do get to pull one advantage out of the extra rain. I haven't had to feed supplemental hay to the sheep flock because their pastures are growing faster than your home yard. Mm-hmm. If you have to mow your yard, you know what that's been like this summer. Yeah. But that also comes with additional disease and parasite issues with the wetness.
We see that with the plants as well. So disease issues, bug issues are there all the time any season, but disease issues are far worse when it's constantly wet.
So Jess, so this brings to mind a reality for farmers, the economics of it. If you can't get the crop in, that means you don't have the crop to harvest.
That's correct.
I mean, how do you budget for that?
So part of what we do in our farm is that we grow 55 different crops. So if we're growing 55 different crops, we are a diverse system. We have an ecology on our farm. Not everything is going to be a crop failure at a given time. We're always going to have something that pulls it through and makes us able to meet payroll and won't be a problem. There are farms that are far less diverse that are monocropping, and they have to rely on things like crop insurance in order to pull through bad weather times.
All right. So we are talking about local farming this hour of Radio Times. We've got three different perspectives in studio with us. Kathy Snyder, founder and executive director of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue. Jess Niederer, fourth generation farmer and the owner of Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey. And Gail Cascella, an animal science teacher at Walter B. Saul High School in Philadelphia. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. More in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're taking a look at local farming in the greater Philadelphia area. Our guests this hour, Gail Cascella, an animal science teacher at Walter B. Saul High School, an agricultural sciences school, which is part of the Philadelphia Public School District. Jess Niederer is the owner of Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey, and Kathy Snyder, founder and executive director of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. So when we were in the break, we were talking a little bit more about food and waste and the fact that this is really how Rolling Harvest comes in, taking some of the food that otherwise would go to waste and getting it to people who could really use it. How do we look at our food so that we waste less?
I'll take a start at that. I had mentioned earlier that the students really get to see the production process from farm to plate throughout the processes at Saul. And I think just getting those connections, seeing what it takes to take a seedling to harvest or actually making breeding choices and delivering animals and raising them and going all the way through the processing – when you have more of an understanding and appreciation of that, you're not going to waste as much.
Yeah. We are really kind of divorced from our food, aren't we, in a large way?
Yeah, I really like that your school is raising more committed individuals in terms of understanding where this is all coming from. Because really, there are a lot of people who shop at farmers markets, at grocery stores, wherever, that are not eating what is in season. We do have a lot of farmers around this area in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Maryland. There are a ton of farmers here. And if you're willing to eat the cabbage in May instead of go to the grocery store and get an imported tomato, that would have and a serious economic impact for your local farmers. Mm.
Is it also more, we don't have a nutritionist here on the panel, but I'm assuming that it's probably better for you if it's grown locally than if it's trucked, you know, from 3,000 miles away.
There's a freshness aspect there that really can't be argued. Nutrient value of many foods starts to decrease the moment it's picked.
And it's much better for the environment to buy local. So in terms of, this is such a sweeping behavioral change that has to take place for us to address food waste and wasted food. That's the new term, wasted food, not food waste. We have to find a way to make it more relevant for everybody. In a very short period of time, we're going to have 9 billion people on this planet. Mm. And we have 40% of all food that's produced right now going to waste, never making it to the end consumer. And then a percentage of that making it to the end consumer, that gets tossed into trash.
Yeah. And sometimes it's because it's as simple as, I just don't like the way that looks. As you said, I think off mic, a three-legged carrot.
We have an impossible demand for
perfection.
For perfection right now. That is not the way nature works. So you have so much food going to waste, even from our local producers, our local growers. And I say one place to start, embrace the imperfection, because if the farmers can sell everything they produce rather than having it go to compost or nourish their soil, that's a big step in the right direction of supporting our local growers, making their work much more sustainable, and changing our perception of perfection, where we're going to not be able to feed everyone on this planet unless there's a major sea change.
One quick comment, Gail, and then we're going to get to the
phones. Really quickly, a coworker, yesterday we were talking about the ideal Saul graduate that we want to produce, and somebody mentioned an outside-of-the-box thinker, and he said, no, we need people to be able to think within the box. And that's interesting to think about, because there are constraints. There are limitations, and we want people who can be creative and be innovative within those constraints that were placed on, whether it's weather or economics or biochemistry. We want to not just imagine the wildest solutions, but be able to look at all of the variety of solutions for some of these major problems, accept that there are some limitations and some boundaries, and then just blow those away.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gail, that's one of my favorite things about farming, actually, is that it does have to make sense within some natural constructs. Yeah.
All right. Tess in Westchester is joining us now. You're live on Radio Times. Hello, Tess.
Hi. How are you?
Well, how are you?
I'm very good. I'm actually very excited to hear that you guys are talking about local agriculture and how it's affecting our country and our climate. I guess my question was more focused on apiarists. I have a good friend, Sam Torres, who owns Keystone Colonies in Philadelphia. And they're actually working on using reclaimed lots to raise bees and honey. And I guess my question is more so, how does that affect the local agriculture and local climate of food stores? And what can we look forward in the future to see from the declining population of bees and how we can help bring them back?
All right. Thanks so much for the call. You're breaking up a bit, so we will let you go. So, Jess, working with apiaries and bees, and there have been questions about stable bee populations in recent decades.
Right. So there's no question that the European honeybee needs a lot of intensive help to nurse it along. The other thing that we're interested in our farm is fostering native pollinator populations. We are lucky in that we have a lot of natural spaces around us, and there have been some university studies on farms right next door to us that show that there is ample pollination from our native pollinators, so we don't need to actually have European honeybee hives on our place. So pollination, essential. Anything that you're eating that is a fruit, like a tomato or an eggplant, it required pollination. In many places, you're not going to have the 1,000-acre nature preserve right next door to provide the native pollinator, in which case you need honeybees. To have honeybees, you need to not kill them with intensive insecticide, fungicides, things that are in the environment that they're going to bring back to their hives.
And so, Gail, you wanted to jump in with something?
We have at times had beehives that are associated with the school. But again, this is where all the pieces of the puzzle kind of come together, because we've got the Natural Resource Management Environmental Program and the food products and processing and the horticulture. And all of those pieces play into having an understanding of all those moving parts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the really cool things at SAWL, is that they get to see the small picture of details and also how all those things play together.
We've got an email from Joan, and also this kind of dovetails with a comment from Peggy. Joan asks, do any of your guests operate via CSAs? How does that help mm-hmm. business-wise? And then Peggy says, one of the core concepts of a CSA, community-supported agriculture, is that the members agree to share the risk of lost crops as well as bumper crops each season. The farmer still gets paid no matter what. And Kathy Snyder, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I think that is an excellent model to help support our local farmers. That's so important that the risk is shared. But then again, the benefit is shared. If CSAs have an excess of something, they're going to offer more to their customers. And it's just a way of this partnership in a community that brings all the resources together and keeps everything very local. CSA, very important
model. Did we see this structure, say, 10, 20 years ago in the Delaware Valley, or is this a relatively
yes.
new development?
Yeah, yes? There's been CSA farms in the area since the early 90s, but it's really burgeoned because we are getting a lot of new farmers and new farms that have yeah. more going
And people
on.
Care about where their food comes from now.
Yeah,
they want to know. They want to have the relationship with the grower.
In the last 10 years at SAWL, we've built up a partnership with Henry Got Crops, which is our CSA farm. And I've been a member of the CSA, also a staff at school, but a beginning member with the CSA. And I consider it an investment in the community, mm-hmm. an investment in the economy.
Right.
And an investment in our family's personal nutrition, because I'm in a position where I can take that risk of saying I'm going to pay you up front and know that you are knowledgeable and hardworking and diligent and will get wonderful things out of it over mm-hmm. the course of the year, and would encourage anybody to look into community-supported agriculture, which is CSA or subscription agriculture.
Right. Sorry. And we have a CSA program that we've had since we started in 2010. We're up to 470 members in our CSA. And the way that we do it, customers are able to have a little bit more flexibility in what they are grabbing from the farm. It operates right out of our farmers market, so it's basically selecting what we have on the table. And that works for a lot of people who might have some picky eaters at home, too.
Okay, to Chester Spring we go, and Mahir. Welcome to Radio Times, Mahir.
Yeah, hi. Thanks
hi.
For having me on. My question is about innovation and what role can it play with farming and agriculture. I hear about aquaponics and, you know, farming in dead spaces like old warehouses and factories where, you know, weather is not as big of a hazard to a mm-hmm. farmer. Are we locally trying anything at large scale or is there any plan, you know, with the school, the SAWL? Mm-hmm. Are we teaching that to kids? I'm just excited about innovation playing a role in agriculture.
Interesting question. Thanks, Mahir. Gail?
Absolutely. We just had a new installation put in the Natural Resource Management Program, and that is an aquaponics system that utilizes fish to process their food into the waste that's used to fertilize the hydroponically grown plants and vegetables. We also do some other things innovative through the other farming areas on the school property that have to do with protecting and producing physical barriers against some of the hazards of pests and things, whether they are low row crops or larger greenhouses. We have had programs, I don't know its status this year, where salad greens and things that are actually produced on the farm are provided through the cafeteria for the students for lunch. The kids get to try things on the farm that they've seen grown and introduce them to things that way. But as far as innovations, that's where we want to be. We want the kids to be comfortable with the process of both dreaming the innovation and implementing the innovations.
Kathy Snyder, we only have a few minutes left of the show, but for our listeners, what do you want to tell them that perhaps you haven't mentioned during this hour about Rolling Harvest, about becoming involved, and about what your mission is?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. It's so important that small organizations, any normal person, any citizen, sees an injustice around, and they know that there's an action they can take. The injustice that we are witness to is food inequality. Rich people just eat better than people who are struggling economically. This should not be, but there's many fixes that may have nothing to do with consumer behavior. It may have to do with public policy. So there's a lot that can be done, and I think everybody can be an ambassador to go out and connect the resources. Keep food out of landfill. Keep more food in the food system that's going to go to people who are really struggling and need access to not just canned and prepared and processed foods that are actually part of the problem.
And you're always looking for volunteers?
We're always looking for volunteers. As I said, we're scratching
gleaners.
Gleaners. Yep. Last minute response. We might give you 2 days notice, but you're going to spend a couple of hours in nature, which is a glorious thing. You're going to start with nothing. And in an hour and a half, you're going to have 40 bins of beautiful organic produce to distribute to the food insecure population right away. It's a great thing for families, and we always need more people. Thank you.
Jess, we've got a Facebook comment from Joni, who is always proud of Jess. We've got some fans out there. Being such a dedicated and hardworking woman in what could be considered a male-dominated field, I can say firsthand her produce is wonderful. But let's just get to that for a moment. I mean, how many women are farmers in that you know of? I mean, is it increasingly becoming kind of a more of an equal playing field or an even playing field?
Yes, there is an increase in female farm owner-operators, I would say, that way. But a lot of the decision-making in ag is still male-dominated. So I would like for more female farmers to get involved with some of those ag governance organizations. I think that would be a great thing, frankly.
And just one quick thing, Rick tweeted, proud to hear our outstanding young Garden State farmer Jess on the air. So
that's
from
nice.
Rick. Yeah. Over to you, Gail. So do you see a kind of an equal proportion of young men and young women in your classes, more interest from the women?
Or I know that Saul's original history was very male-dominated. In the time that I have been at Saul as an agricultural educator, the number of women in the field has grown exponentially. A lot of the men have retired. Some of that has to do with the pay for educators. Some of that has to do with the fact that women are just being able to make headway into some of those more career technical fields. And in our classes, we're majority female students. The men, young men, step it up, come to Saul.
And you say that now, because we're running a little short of time, but now is the time, if you're heading in, you have a child who's heading into eighth grade, that now's the time to kind of make a decision if you want to apply to some place like Saul.
Yeah, the high
in Philadelphia school district.
Yes, in Philadelphia schools, the high school selection process comes up very, very quickly in the school year, guys. So make sure that you are looking around, if you haven't already, sixth grade, seventh grade. It's not too early to start looking at the programs your kids are excited about.
And quickly, Jess and Kathy, good harvest this fall. How's it looking, Jess?
We'll see if it stops raining. That would be nice.
We're always hopeful.
Thanks so much. Kathy Snyder is the founder and executive director of Rolling Harvest Food Rescue, an organization in Bucks County which connects hunger relief sites with local farmers to help distribute extra produce to those who are food insecure. Great to have you along.
Thank you.
Jess Niederer, again, thanks to you as well, owner of Chickadee Creek Farm in Pennington, New Jersey.
Great to be here.
And Gail Koskela, it was a pleasure.
Nice.
Gail is an animal sciences teacher at the Walter B. Saul Agricultural Sciences High School, which is part of the Philadelphia Public School District. And as always, if you'd like to connect with us here at Radio Times, head to whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in to Radio Times.